going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. We do have a quorum. So the first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for the February 21st meeting of Government Operations. Could I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Mason?
Move approval.
Okay, thank you, Representative Mason, for moving approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the minutes are adopted. Members, I just want to direct your attention to your packets. There are a couple bill referral memos in there dated February 22nd and February 25th. I also want to let you know we were planning on hearing House File 70, Representative Kunesh Pudin's bill related to the Task Force on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. But it was pending referral. It was listed that way, and it was the referral did not happen in a timely manner. So yesterday, so we will not be hearing that one today. Just want to make sure everybody knows that in case there is anybody here who came with interest in that bill. So the first bill we will be taking up is House File 11, Representative Lesh's bill. Representative Lesh, welcome to the committee. I will move that your bill, House File 11, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And do you have an author's amendment, Representative Lesh?
I don't know. Right?
yes, you do. It's House File. It's dated H. It's marked H0011A2. So this, as I understand it, would put the bill in the shape that you would like it to be in.
Yes.
So I will move the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative
Wong. If the author's not aware of the amendment, did it make deadline?
Yes, it did, and it was posted to our website.
I'm aware of it now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your attention to make sure all the processes are followed, Representative Wong. Any discussion on the A2 amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment is carried. Representative Lesh, the bill is in the shape you would like it. If you would please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the bill is before you today to address the enforcement authority granted to Dolly in Article 2 of the bill. This is an authority that will have an effect on how much earned sick and safe time will be implemented in the state of Minnesota for the benefit of workers here. So ultimately, we're here today because we want Minnesota to be a caring state where our families are healthy and safe, but for too many Minnesotans, that is not the case. Right now, an estimated 36% of working people, or 932,000 Minnesotans, currently do not have access to paid sick and safe time. This means in a state with the second most Fortune 500 companies per capita, mothers and fathers must often face a terrible choice between caring for themselves or loved ones in need and the loss of wages or even employment, because in many circumstances, it is still legal for workers to be fired for needing to take time off to care for themselves or for a loved one. And a significant likely subject of this enforcement mechanism is the administrative procedures to help protect workers who need access to this time off. So this common sense bill also benefits employers through improved recruitment and retention, lower employer health care costs through better use of preventative care, and lower presenteeism, which is coming to work sick and coughing on all of your other employees and getting them sick. So this results would result in higher productivity and fewer workplace injuries. And another significant role for enforcement is to help employers who are already offering similar benefits. So based upon our current experiences, members in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, which has passed ordinances to this, as well as the experience of the 11 other states that have passed similar bills, the likely topics for this enforcement will focus on helping employers and employees understand how their specific situations fit within the context of the law, and what both employers and employers can do to protect their rights under the law. So this could include administrative procedures that the commissioner will use to investigate, to make determinations, to handle appeals. It could include providing clarity for employers on what constitutes an equivalent benefit or comparable position. So I'll defer to the commissioner on what topics they would need to promulgate rules, and I believe they're here to testify. We'll see if that's the case. I would just state, Mr. Chair, that of those jurisdictions, the 11 states and countless more jurisdictions that have passed a version of this law, you hear very, very little objection from the business community as to the ongoing effect and scope of this law. It's not uncommon that when we propose to regulate an industry or a trade, that you'll hear lamentations that the sky is falling and everything's going to be bad. You know, I suppose if I was an employer in that industry, I might say the same thing. But in this case, we have the benefit of hindsight to over 10 years of implementation of policies like this across the nation. And universally, we've heard from them that it is a good practice. It works for employers and employees. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would pause at this time and give an opportunity to hear from other testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. And just so members are aware, the portions of the bill that are within the jurisdiction of government operations are likely Article 2, which directs compliance activities by DALI. That probably relates, you know, this committee has jurisdiction over bills that would bring about a substantial change to the powers and duties of an agency. And also within Article 2, Section 1, Subdivision 2 has rulemaking authority. I'll try to limit discussion to those, but that's what that is. We do have several testifiers. Representative Quam, did you have a quick question before we go into testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I basically was looking for a clarification because the author stated that employees would be fired for taking time off for taking care of family, and I wanted clarification of what the federal Family Leave Act, I thought that extended protections for a period of time to prevent that. And so I thought federal law still had jurisdiction within our state boundaries.
I have an answer to that, but if I could have a testifier speak to that specifically, the short answer would be, Ms. Chair and Representative Quam, that it doesn't require that employees be fired for taking time off. In Minnesota, it is still legal for employers to... for employees to be fired for taking time off.
You have
to
chair
through a series of hoops
maybe
in order
not
to implement.
Can let Representative Lesh
thank you, Ms. Chair. In order to implement FMLA, and if you don't jump through those specific hoops, then you don't have its protections. But I'd ask
Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
I would like nonpartisan staff, because, again, I believe federal law has jurisdiction over the state of Minnesota. And that if you take time off, because I know it's fairly common for the Federal Family Leave Act for people to do so. And so, clarification, does not federal law let us know that you aren't fired as long as you are taking it off for taking care of family? And maybe give us an idea of the length of time that the federal law protects the workers for taking off?
We have a special guest here from House Research, Mr. Weeks. Would you care to take that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, the Family and Medical Leave Act, the federal law, protects workers who are employed at an employer who has 50 more employees, so it doesn't cover everyone in the state of Minnesota. And there's also an incumbency requirement, so you have to have worked there for a certain amount of time. It also doesn't cover things that would be covered under House File 11, like a short flu, like a three-day flu, or a sick kid with a flu. That you need under the federal FMLA a seven-day qualifying event, so it has to be a more serious thing, like broken leg that requires a series of doctor's visit or an inpatient care. So there is... Though the federal law and the state law do apply together in Minnesota, there is some gaps in who has these employment protections that House File 11 fills in some of those gaps.
Okay, Representative Quam.
Then, Mr. Chair, if the in order to be clear, if the author and the testifiers can illuminate as to what is additionally given in this would be given in this bill that's not already covered by, you know, cases where people would be fired and you're protecting them, because that was a major component of the introduction by the author.
Okay. Do you have a quick clarification, Chair Lesh, or your testifier?
Sure, Mr. Chair. This covers you if you work with less than 50 people in Minnesota that FMLA doesn't. And I guess, I mean, I can't give a better answer than Mr. Weeks did. I mean, I think he spelled out pretty clearly that there are large gaps that where Minnesotans aren't protected. Okay. So yep. We're protecting those in this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Lesh. We have several people testifying. So just so members know what's going on, there's quite a few testifiers on both bills today. I'm going to be a little stricter than I have been on other meetings with the time limits for testimony. I'm going to attempt to limit people to 2 minutes for testimony per person, just to make sure everybody has an opportunity to speak, because there are a lot of people here, and I want to make sure everyone, you know, especially if they've driven in a long way, gets an opportunity to speak. So, Mr. Elliott, you are the first person I have on the list here. If you could please just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Brian Elliott. I am the SEIU Minnesota State Council Executive Director, and I served on the Minneapolis Workplace Partnership Group that included 19 representatives of employees, varying sized employers, labor organizations, and business groups that studied and recommended an earned sick and safe time policy to the City of Minneapolis City Council following dozens of hours of discussion and community listening sessions with various cultural communities and different sized employers and their employees from a host of industries. Specifically for today's hearing, I've remained active through the earned sick and safe time rulemaking process in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. The initial months-long process served to provide additional clarity for both employees and employers about the process the city would follow in enforcement, as well as in determining the application of those ordinances to the specific situations of employers and employees. The rules provided important guidance that served to protect not just employees, including many that SEIU represents, but also employers as well, including nonprofit employers such as myself. A key piece of clarity in determining was in determining what was an equivalent benefit that employers may already be offering. While the bill before you requires that employers meet some minimum standards, including accrual rates and amounts, rate of pay for time used, purposes of use, and conditions of use, the rulemaking process was able to dig deeper into these issues and address additional issues like front-loading of paid days and specific carryover policies. It's exactly this type of clarity that the public rulemaking process would have for this bill, and SEIU supports that process and the bill as a whole. To Representative Quam's question or request that testifiers address, this bill differs greatly from the paid family medical leave bill that you are also hearing today, in that it is intended to address short-term needs of employers that both the Federal Family Medical Leave Act and House File 5 are not able to address, because they do require a one-week qualifying event before you can qualify for the protections under those bills. This bill would provide protections for employees who run into school closures or other closures of their parents' care, closures of their own business due to weather or other public emergencies. It would cover single-day events or even single-hour events. One of the most compelling stories we heard was that of school staff who have sick kids that come into the school nurse's office or the school social worker's office, and that school staff calls their parent, and that parent literally cannot come to get their child without facing risk of losing their job, and that poor child then has to sit in the nurse's office for the rest of the day.
Yep.
So
thank you, Mr. Elliott. I let you go a little longer since you were responding to a specific member comment. Let's see. The second testifier I have on the list is Danny Schwartzman.
Thank you. I'm Danny Schwartzman. I own Common Roots Cafe and Common Roots Catering in Minneapolis. I served on the same committee as Brian in Minneapolis that reviewed the earned sick and safe time options and made some recommendations to the council there. I'm here for a number of reasons that probably can't be voiced in 2 minutes, but I believe strongly that earned sick and safe time is good for our community. I believe that as a business owner. I believe that as a parent. I believe that as someone who has 50-plus employees who have things happen to them. So, like, they get sick. And I mean, it's a food service business. You don't want people working sick. You just expect that people don't come to work sick, and you'd expect that people don't worry about getting fired for coming to work sick. They do. Many of the people I've employed have experience working at other businesses, and despite the fact that we've had paid time off in my business since we opened in 2007, people regularly work for other businesses that don't. And they don't have that experience of having an employer that says, don't come to work if you're sick. And they don't have experience with a worker that doesn't say, I might fire you if you don't show up to work sick because I need you to come and do this job. And with this paid sick time option that we now have in Minneapolis, that's no longer the standard practice. We have a basic increase in the working standard for all employees in our city, and it's a critical improvement for me and for my business and for my community. I also think that rulemaking is important in this. There are a lot of questions that business owners have. I think there's a lot of fear amongst the business community of any kind of new regulation, and we're all working in challenging industries. Restaurants are some of the most challenging, where margins are low and pressure is high. Any kind of new regulation is going to be questioned. I think there are important questions that come up in rulemaking, like equivalency of benefits and other kinds of important things. And I think it's important that the lawmakers and others and the people who actually do the rulemaking think about the direct opinions of business owners, because there's a lot of fear. And I think when you actually get into it, the questions aren't that complicated, and the little details can be worked out. And the bigger picture of this is having our entire community have access to basic standards of work that work for people. And when our employees can work and be happy and not worry about being sick and what that happens with their job for a minor illness, our community is stronger and we can retain more employees. And it's certainly a community I prefer to work in and live in and run a business in. And I'm excited for the possibility that can expand across the state.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Schwartz. The next speaker I have on the list is Stephanie Menning.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Stephanie Menning. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Utility Contractors Association, or MUCA. We represent over 130 contractors and suppliers engaged in excavation, site work, and construction of underground infrastructure. These are critical services necessary for everyday life that are often taken for granted until Minnesotans can't take a hot shower or get a clean glass of water. I'm here today in hopes of persuading this body to preserve the rights of private employers. MUCA members and their thousands of employees request that you protect commerce by not enacting a one-size-fits-all package. Solving a problem for the few by punishing the many with a broad-brush mandate does not work. Last month, the Department of Employment and Economic Development reported that Minnesota is at 2.8% unemployment for the fourth month in a row. It's now dropped to 2.6% for the Twin Cities. As I'm sure you know, 3% unemployment is considered as full employment. Deed also stated that for the full year, Minnesota added 31,441 jobs, a growth rate of 1.1%. That was below the national rate of 1.8% and ranks us 27th nationally, 12 spots worse from 2017. In other words, we are already headed in the wrong direction. Workplace mandates will continue to hurt Minnesota's job growth rate and will have a negative effect. The construction industry in particular already suffers from a major lack of available workers, as noted by the several bills this body is proposing to increase funding to organizations that attract workers to the trades. As I personally found out when I wasn't able to keep my plan or my doctor, government is never the correct solution when it comes to these types of mandates. Thank God the free market offered me an alternative solution through health sharing programs and health savings accounts. Last year in January, my mother was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. My sister, who was her main caretaker, had asked me to come and get Mom because her husband had suffered a stroke 2 weeks earlier. I am the sole employee of MUCA, a nonprofit organization. My board allowed me to work remotely from my mom's house until she passed for over 2 months. My board of directors did not need a government intervention to do what's right. Most employers don't. I am continually awestruck by those who believe that the government taking more of our pay and more of our employers' profit will somehow magically result in more prosperity for all. It never has. It never will. I ask you to consider the undue burden these labor mandates place on business. They will increase costs to both the employers and their employees and will result in Minnesota's continuing decline in the job growth rate. For those that are here in support of this bill, I implore you, if you are not getting the benefits you believe you deserve, or if you think your job isn't offering enough pay, time off, or coverage, the construction industry has jobs, lots of jobs, and we need a wide variety of skill sets, and they will train you. Great pay.
If you could please wrap up your testimony.
Winter's off. Yeah. Thank you for your time today.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. The next speaker is Lauren Schotthorst. And I did speak to Ms. Schotthorst in advance. She requested permission to go a little bit longer so that she could speak towards both House File 11 and House File 5. So I said that would be fine so that she only needs to come up here once. Okay, and then the next person, if you want to get ready on the list that I have, is Adam Hansen from the Builders and Contractors, if you want to just come approach the podium. So welcome, Ms. Schotthorst, if you could please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schotthorst, and I serve as the policy director for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce doing labor and management policy. The Minnesota Chamber represents 2,300 employers and over 500,000 employees in every industry across the state. The majority of our members are small and mid-sized businesses and also include many of Minnesota's Fortune 500 headquartered companies. I appreciate the opportunity to share our perspective of our members on both of these bills today. To start, our members share the goal of giving Minnesotans access to the time they need to take care of themselves and their loved ones. Throughout this process, we have shared how companies across the state are providing paid leave already, and they're doing so without mandates. This approach enables our companies to provide innovative benefits to attract and retain employees in a competitive marketplace while ensuring their particular business can grow, perform, stay viable. A state-dictated benefit mandate takes away this flexibility and comes with paperwork and reporting compliance mechanisms that add on additional costs, legal exposure, and challenges to our members' operations. Our members have developed practices and benefits specifically tailored to account for their workforce and economic issues in a way that works for their operations and their employees. These bills are also coming at a time when we are experiencing a well-documented workforce shortage that is projected to get worse. It bears repeating, balancing employer and employee needs, program scope, and costs are really important components of the conversation we're having here today. When discussing Minnesota's economy and business challenges with our members, I consistently hear that the costs of doing business are too darn high in Minnesota, and employees are their most valuable asset. On a national scale, Minnesota is less competitive because public policies makes our cost of doing business higher than in many other states. From taxes top five to electricity rates 15th and 20th, to health insurance and workers' comp premiums 31st and 22nd, it is becoming increasingly difficult to keep our Minnesota companies strong. We are here today because we are concerned that these bills impose new fees, liability, and unworkable one-size-fits-all leave mandates on our businesses. House File 5 imposes a new payroll tax on every employer to create a broad new state-administered insurance program that conservatively will cost tens of millions of dollars and years of development to start up. It also creates a mechanism for an employee to be away from their job for 24 weeks in a given year. That's 44% of a working year. In certain workplaces, such as hospitals or manufacturing facilities that run 24/7, extended leaves, as outlined in that bill, would compound already almost critical staffing shortages. House File 5, on the other hand, and in the same vein, mandates that employers offer fully paid time off in a specific format for an expanded set of familial persons for an extended list of qualifying events. The bill requires to maintain specific records in a specific format or risk significant fines and expanded liabilities. We have heard from our members in cities that have these local ordinances, and of course, they are all different and different from the bill before us, who are struggling already with costs, regulatory burdens, and staffing obligations. I want to reiterate to the committee that employers consider their workforce one of the most valuable parts of their business. This is why they provide benefits and flexibility to retain trained and skilled employees. Employers also, however, rely on physical presence, particularly in small businesses, and expertise, skills, and institutional knowledge that cannot always be simply replaced or put aside to comply with the specific terms outlined in these mandates. And again, employers today are already struggling to fill vacancies with qualified and ready individuals. While we appreciate the goals of the proposals, we are concerned about their expansiveness of the benefits, how they are funded, and the challenges that they separately and together present in terms of managing the needs of individual workplaces, industries, and employees in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to share our perspective on both of these bills.
Thank you for your testimony. Is Adam Hansen from the Associate Builders and Contractors here? Okay, yep. And then next up will be Ben Wogsland from Hospitality Minnesota. If you want to come down and to get ready, that would be great. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hansen. If you could please proceed, identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Adam Hansen. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. Our contractor members throughout the state and their craft professionals that they employ are part of the 70% of construction workers that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. We share the sentiments and the concerns that were raised by previous testifiers, but what I want to talk about is how this bill specifically affects the construction industry in general. Under the bill, contractors are allowed to exempt themselves from the sick and safe time mandate if they pay their craft professionals prevailing wage rates set by the Department of Labor and Industry, even if the project is not funded by the state. Currently, prevailing wage laws only apply to projects funded in whole or in part with state dollars. This means that private construction like single-family homes, senior living facilities, and other projects in your districts, as well as county, local, and school construction, aren't subject to prevailing wage laws. We have concerns about the method DALI uses to calculate those prevailing wage rates, but that's a conversation for another time. Exempting contractors from the sick and safe time mandate by paying a prevailing wage rate doesn't give an employee the sick and safe time that this bill seeks to provide them. Our contractors pay their employees based on merit, based on experience, not a one-size-fits-all wage rate set by the state. And because prevailing wage rates vary county by county, the prevailing wage exemption would create an 87-county compliance fiasco for contractors, depending upon where they're building at that particular time. And there are countless examples of prevailing wage rates in neighboring side-by-side counties that vary drastically. So there's not a lot of consistency in those prevailing wage rates that we see today. And as other folks have said, with the high demand for skilled construction craft professionals across the state, our contractors are already providing competitive wage, hour, and benefit packages to attract, train, and retain these employees without the need for new legislation in our industry. ABC and our members, like I said, have concerns about this bill and its attempt at implementing a one-size-fits-all wage and benefit package that doesn't take into consideration what the industry is already doing. Thank you, members of the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Representative Zerwas, was your question for this testifier?
Yes, it's for the testifier, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Proceed with the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to the testifier. With the scenario that you described, with prevailing wages being different county by county, is there a scenario then where an employer may have employees going from job site to job site where in some instances they would be exempted from this safe and sick leave policy, but in some instances where they wouldn't be, and so some job sites, you count their hours towards accrual of safe and sick time, but then some job sites that they showed up to work that somehow wouldn't count towards their accrual, and then would it be the employer's job to keep all of that straight and notify the employee that, you know, oh, that last week you worked 3 miles east of here, so you actually didn't accrue any safe and sick time, because 3 miles east, your sniffles don't count as much?
Mr. Hansen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, in short, yes, with all of that. To unpack it a little bit, especially in the merit shop construction world, contractors are going to pay, let's say they're electricians, the same if they're working in, and this is on private work, if it's a prevailing wage project, state law applies. They're going to pay their electrician the same they do in Sherburne County as they do in Wright County. It won't matter that, you know, that they're working on a school that doesn't have prevailing wage trigger, or if they're building a Chipotle restaurant. They're going to pay that electrician what he or she is going to get paid. And the other thing to take note is, like I said, our contractors pay based on merit and experience. So you might have a first-year journeyman electrician getting paid, just picking a number, $35. But the person he's working alongside with, who's been in the company for 10 years, has much more experience, might be getting paid $45 an hour or more. And so depending upon what those prevailing wage rates are in the county, somebody might be getting paid more than prevailing wage, and the person working alongside him or her is going to be paying less than prevailing wage on a private rate work. And so there's going to be a bookkeeping nightmare for that employer who's charged with keeping track of those hours and those mandates. So it's creating kind of a two-tiered system for employees within the same company, depending on how much they're getting paid.
We're veering a little ways away from the topic of agency authority or rulemaking, but I understand, Representative Lesh, you would like to comment as well.
I just wanted to clarify, Mr. Scheer, there's a myth being shopped that there's a carve-out in the bill, or exemption, I think, as it was phrased. Folks who pay prevailing wage in the state of Minnesota are already required to offer this in statute. In statute, prevailing wage is the calculation, includes consideration for compensation for injuries or illness resulting from occupational activity and disability and sickness insurance or accident insurance and other bona fide fringe benefits. So there's not an exemption. It's that if you're doing prevailing wage, your employees are already getting this. So we thought that we needn't add another duplicative layer on top of that as a benefit. Clarification, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Zerwas, follow-up, hopefully to the topic of agency authority and or rulemaking.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think as we talk about creating a brand new process to administer this statewide in what clearly seems to be kind of a patchwork approach, I think the agency's ability to enforce this is perfectly at hand here. I'm wondering if the testifier has comments to Chair Lesh's assertion that this is already in statute and being done for prevailing wage shops.
Mr. Hansen, brief response.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, yes. So prevailing wage, there's a certified wage rate that the department sets that's comprised of two components. One is the hourly wage rate that an employee gets per hour, and then a fringe benefit. And now an employer can satisfy the certified wage rate, which is the highest amount of combined of those two. They can satisfy that by paying the entire portion of it in cash or in an hourly wage rate without providing any benefits. And so it's up to the employer to meet that certified wage rate in any combination of wage and benefits, but there's nothing that requires any health insurance time off or any other bona fide fringe benefits in statute.
Okay. Representative Zerwas?
Mr. Chair, question for the author. Knowing that that's how it's done in the field, are you still interested in carving those folks out?
Well, Chair Lesh?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to offer an amendment, or actually accept an amendment from the Republicans that said you would be paid, let's say, 30% more than your current rate of wage, or 40% more, in lieu of offering these sick time benefits. So if that's a proposal, I mean, I think it's potentially palatable. Maybe 40% increase in pay in lieu of having a sick time might be good, Mr. Chair. But that's a great idea, Representative Zerwas, and let's talk about it. I'm interested in seeing an amendment.
Representative Zerwas?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just here to make Representative Lesh's bill just that much more appealing. Representative Lesh, I think it's pretty clear in some of the testimony that we've had that there isn't a requirement in statute to cover these benefits like perhaps you're under the impression. So knowing that some of these contractors don't offer those benefits, do you still want to carve them out of this requirement?
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas. I'll reiterate, there's no carve-out. If you already offering the opportunity to have this, and an employer can choose to either offer prevailing wage or not offer prevailing wage. Prevailing wage is a critical and important program in the state of Minnesota to make sure people are paid their worth and that employers can't import foreign workers to do jobs for pennies on the dollar. It protects workers. So if the proposal that I'm hearing is that prevailing wage should be available to all workers in the state of Minnesota, I think that's an interesting point. But this is not a carve-out. This is you either offer prevailing wage or you offer sick and safe leave. So I think that's a benefit to employers. I wouldn't think that extending prevailing wage to every single employee in the state of Minnesota, I think there'd probably be a lot more industry and, you know, Chamber of Commerce lobbyists in this room if we offered that, Mr. Chair. But I think this is a more palatable to them.
Representative Zerwas, I have one more member question, and I would like to
Mr.
testimony is completed, but do you have a
follow-up? Mr. Chair, I guess what I would assert is this idea that if you have prevailing wage, you don't need to offer sick and safe. I mean, we just heard testimony saying that it's better for employees not to come to work sick. It's better. It's safer. It's better. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around your thought process. That is it that someone's sickness is less impactful if their employer pays prevailing wage, or do you still get the flu as bad? Does your temperature still go as high? Do your symptoms still go as high? I'm just trying to figure out how if your employer pays prevailing wage, they don't need to provide you sick or safe time. But if your employer doesn't pay prevailing wage, they do need to provide you a sick or safe time. So I'm just wondering if there's some other benefit of prevailing wage that makes colds not that bad.
Well, Representative Lesh.
I think the idea is, Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, that if you're working on a job site for $25 an hour, let's say that's a prevailing wage, and if you get sick, you can afford to take a couple days off to get sick at that. If you're not protected by prevailing wage, and your employer is going to hire a foreign worker to do your job at $11 an hour, you're that much more threatened, and you're going to come to work sick. So I think the protection that prevailing wage offers you is the ability to maintain your livelihood, whether you get sick or not. And as I would restate that, you know, if we're talking about offering prevailing wage to everyone in the state, I'm still open to that amendment.
Okay. Representative Nash, quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hansen, quick question for you. Average wage, I've been talking with you and your cohorts. Would $35 an hour be an okay number to do some basic math off of as to what you're paying your employees?
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, depending upon the county, depending upon the trade, I mean, if you're a sprinkler fitter, if you're a plumber, a pipe fitter, electrician, I mean, that's going to be incredibly low, especially if you've obtained your licensure.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks, if you're a plumber, licensed plumber, you can be getting paid $60, $70, $80 or more.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
Nash?
And to that, and you'll have to indulge me, I've got some math that I wanted to run in assumptions, because this is all great to talk about in a theoretical concept as to what this might look like, but let's put some numbers to it to actually find out what this does. So let's say it's $35 an hour, and a company has about 20 employees. They get 48 hours per year bankable, 80 hours for 2 years on the upside. So let's look at that, what it means at $35 an hour. Times 48 hours that they get to bank, that's $1,680 per person per year, and that nets out to $33,600 that they are able to get paid per year at the one-year rate, $56,000 at the two-year rate. Now carry that out for, say, a business in say, my district, 47A. Let's say we have only 50 businesses, only 50, and we got way more than that. At the one-year liability rate, you've created a new burden of $1.68 million. At the two-year, you've got $2.8 million in liabilities out there. And it is a liability because it doesn't have to get used. But now let's spread that across the state, and let's go with a low number of, say, 1,000 businesses, just 1,000. You've now created that as a $33,600,000 liability at the one-year rate. Two-year rate, $56 million. These are incredibly low numbers for by district, by state. And I was talking with Representative Vogel here, and what this could also do, members, is this could create a liability on the books of a business that could preclude them from getting credit to expand their business. Because if they've got $56,000 of new liability on their book and they're running a lean business, they may be denied for future credit. And so, Representative Lesch, this is a staggering number from my perspective. And as somebody who has a lot of entrepreneurs in my district, many of whom are in the trades, I share Mr. Hansen's concern. These are big numbers, big numbers. And my number of $35 an hour could be quite low. So now, let's all get out our calculators or slide rules or whatever. This is a staggering number, and I'm just deeply concerned by this. And Mr. Hansen, thanks for your testimony. This is pretty frightening.
I didn't exactly hear a question there, but thank you for your...
I had a question about the wages.
Oh, okay. All right, Representative Hansen. I'm sorry, Mr. Hansen. did you have a brief response?
I don't. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then the next testifier on the list is Ben Waldsland of Hospitality Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ben Waldsland. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Hospitality Minnesota. We are the umbrella organization representing Minnesota restaurants, hotels, lodges, campgrounds, and resorts. The hospitality industry provides over 250,000 jobs in Minnesota currently and $5.4 billion in wages in communities across the state and generates nearly 18% of all sales tax in the state currently. I want to say that we appreciate the spirit of what the author is attempting to do with this bill, but we do want to share some concerns that we have. Hospitality employers, many of which are small businesses throughout your communities, value their employees immensely, and many of our members are able to already provide paid leave benefits. However, many small businesses, like restaurants, operate on extremely thin margins, as you probably know. Even though they may be small, they do represent jobs, and we want to help them grow and be successful in Minnesota. It's widely reported that as many as half of restaurants do not survive their first year, and 80% did not survive the first five. Although small businesses want to do the right thing, the financial burden is significant, and many simply cannot afford to offer more paid benefits at this time. For these reasons, Hospitality Minnesota favors an opt-in approach to address paid leave and work collaboratively with small businesses. One way the legislature could approach this would be to create an additional tax incentives to small businesses for offering certain paid leave benefits or participating in a state paid leave program. I would note that in other jurisdictions and other states that have passed paid leave legislation, they have acknowledged the challenges facing small businesses and crafted their laws to address those challenges, including in some cases exempting small businesses from certain provisions. Again, while we appreciate the author's intent, we believe that an opt-in approach would better balance the financial squeeze that many small businesses are facing with the good intentions of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes my comments on House File 11. If it pleases the committee, I could also spend 30 seconds on House File 5, or I can come back.
Thank you, Mr. Waldsland. Since I did allow another testifier that opportunity, I guess
very,
it makes sense.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Very briefly then, I would like to incorporate the statements I made with regard to small businesses and the financial squeeze, which also applies to this bill. Again, we appreciate the author's spirit of the bill. We do have some concerns. It's been somewhat challenging to communicate with our members about the scope and impact that this bill could have on them without already having the premium rate set or what those premiums might be or the share between the employees and the employers. That is one concern that we have. In addition, it's my understanding that other states that have created similar programs have assessed the payroll tax solely on the employees with the understanding that it is an employee benefit. And finally, the federal FMLA Act takes into consideration the financial squeeze faced by many small businesses and exempts employers with less than 50 employees from certain requirements. The bill as drafted does not track these provisions, so this change in law could be dramatic for small employers. We do appreciate, I believe there is at least a proposed amendment to provide additional assistance to small businesses, and I have not had a chance to thoroughly review that yet. We appreciate that the author is offering that, but I'm not sure that it goes quite far enough to provide the financial support that some of those small businesses would need. So I appreciate the committee's time, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Waldsland, for your testimony. That is all the people I have who've signed up previously or in advance of the hearing. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? If so, please raise your hand. Okay, I'm not seeing any. So I'll close the testimony and we'll go to member discussion. Members, take it away. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, I have several concerns being a small business owner in that we have a small home inspection company where it's my husband. I do the books, but right now I'm not an employee. We have our son working with us in a part-time. So my questions have to do a little bit with, you know, the salaried part of it and how we're calculating that and what it means to me. Also, and we have ups and downs in our business, where right now we're not as busy as we could be in the spring and summer where homes are being sold a little bit more. But I'm also thinking if you have a seasonal worker and that person is laid off and they have an event then that they're sick or they're laid off, they're getting unemployment benefits. But if they get sick, what happens? Do they get paid sick leave as well?
Well,
Representative Lesh.
Sure. I would ask, first, I guess my answer would be no, because it's not meant to cover those benefits for which are already in place. However, I would note that this is the second committee out of four or five committees that we're at. And is it still your intention to keep this within Article 2, the questions that we're going to be addressing here, or are we going to open it up?
It's my intention to focus on agency authority, okay, and rulemaking. So if you could keep it brief, that'd be great.
Well, if I could have Mr. Elliott address, sure, that portion of it then.
Mr. Elliott.
Thank you again. My name is Brian Elliott. Representative Tice, to your question, specifically in the bill, seasonal employees are addressed in the way that the employer is not required to provide the accrued paid sick and safe time until after someone has worked 90 calendar days. So that does address some seasonal employment, as well if someone is not employed or is taking unemployment, they do not qualify for earned sick and safe time. And there's also a provision in the bill for if someone is rehired, period of separation is more than 180 days, they will have lost their accrued sick and safe time that they had previously accrued.
Okay. Representative Tice?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, we really didn't hear much testimony or talk about what some of the rulemaking might entail. What types of things do we think that would be?
Well, Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, I'm not going to speculate. I think that's what the committee process is for. I think we gamed out scenarios as to how we could implement this in the most fair manner. And the point of the committee process is for people to come up and say, hey, this will affect me or this could affect me. So I think the point of the open hearing is people to come up and say, well, this is going to be bad if you make this rule. You can or can't do this rule. So I guess I'd rather not speculate as to what could happen, because I think that's the point of the...
Huh?
Okay, well... Mr. Chair, Mr. Elliott could speak to the, I mean, he worked on the Minneapolis one, so he could speak to some of the ones that came up there.
Sure. Mr. Elliott.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. Representative Tice, the two of the most significant portions of rulemaking for Minneapolis and St. Paul involve the administrative process that the department would use to investigate, take in, and make determinations on claims, both as well as the process that employers and employees could both use to appeal the decisions of the department. The other key piece was to clarify equivalency. What does count as an equivalent plan that is offered, might be called paid time off, might be offered as vacation days or other paid days off, and at what point is a plan equivalent?
Okay. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, are we going to hear from the commissioner at all?
Representative Lesh.
Sure. Commissioner doesn't work for me, so I don't know.
Well,
Representative Tice?
If we're sticking to rulemaking, we're not even hearing from anybody who's talking about rulemaking. I mean, is the commissioner available?
Representative Lesch?
Not to be too blunt, but that's your job. That's why we're having this committee, is to ask about, hey, this could be the rule. How are you going to implement this rule? And then if the commissioner is here to answer a specific question as to a question posed by a committee member on rulemaking, we could hear from him.
Okay. Is the commissioner or anyone from the agency here?
I believe the commissioner was here. If he is, we'd like to talk to him.
I see Ms. Perusha coming down. Ms. Chair, if I guess if there's a specific question as to what rule could be promulgated, I guess that's what I would request.
The question I heard, Representative Tice, is just what sorts of rules might be promulgated. I mean, Mr. Elliott did give some examples of that. Is there a specific question that you would like Ms. Perushek to address?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's basically we're looking at this, and I mean, there's no fiscal impact at all to this, and I'm thinking there is going to be. There probably will be, and part of a fiscal note also tells us how the money is going to be spent and what the plan is to get things in place, and it really bothers me that we don't have that. But I think what would be more impactful is to have a fiscal impact from what it'll cost companies to implement this, especially our smaller companies. I mean, when I look at this earned sick leave and the other bill, that HF5, it's going to cost my company a lot, and we're only 3 people. But yet we don't look at the impact of that. We talk a lot about the bargaining units, but that doesn't include the small companies. So I'm very concerned about what this will do, and to be able to not, I mean, this is the only place I'm going to see this probably. It's very frustrating to not be asking you any questions about anything, and then when our only purview is about rulemaking and we have no clue what that might mean, it's just very frustrating, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tice, this is going to a finance committee. We are not a finance committee, so the finance questions will be addressed in that committee. We did hear some examples about what rulemaking might involve, so I don't think it's a fair statement to say we're not discussing that at all. Ms. Perushek, perhaps you could shed some additional light briefly about what the rulemaking might involve.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members. Kate Perushek, Director of Legislative Affairs at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Our commissioner was unable to be here today, but she did prepare a statement about our rulemaking authority, and she said the department would only exercise its rulemaking authority if necessary to effectively administer and enforce the new law. The point would be to ensure that employers and workers understand their rights and responsibilities. So we look forward to working with the author on what that rulemaking might entail. We do also have a fiscal note request pending at the agency that we are working on.
Representative Tice? Okay, Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to rulemaking, I'd like apparently the testifier present can address that. What systems are there existing that are similar to the tracking and reporting that would be required in this bill? So we can have an idea of systems and the types of rules that they implemented in order to be able to effectively do the legislation.
Ms. Perushek?
Mr. Chair and members, currently the department does enforce the current unpaid sick time law in Chapter 181. We do have limited rulemaking authority to carry out other responsibilities of the department.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, as an example, reading the bill, it appears that you would have employees counted as defined employees working less than 2 hours per week. So the example of a sub for a daycare provider, in-home daycare provider, who has to is required to have training per year, that's just subbing for the training, easily would qualify as an employee. Is that something that is already being tracked with that other system?
Ms. Perushek.
Mr. Chair and members, we do follow the law in terms of the definition of who is an employee, and again, in terms of the details of this bill, we look forward to working with the author to clarify those questions.
Mr. Chair, I didn't hear an answer. You referenced an existing program of where you're tracking that's similar. So a person that is an employee for less than 2 hours a week, and I gave an example, and I know that we have a lot of tracking on licensed in-home daycare providers. So they've got a person subbing for while they're off for training, would accrue and be defined as, does the other system define an employee of anyone working 80 hours in an entire year?
Ms. Perushek?
Mr. Chair and Representative Plum, we'd have to look more closely at the definition. I'm happy to get back to you with a better answer.
Mr. Chair, so do we have someone that maybe would be able to understand the complexities that would be involved in the rulemaking and the monitoring system and the tracking system and the paperwork and, you know, the burdens and requirements that this bill would entail? If the other system is not, I thought the testifier would be familiar enough to understand that the system that she referenced, what was defined as an employee within that system, since she used that as a comparable example. So is there someone that is familiar enough to be able to answer our questions, or
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam,
available?
Just a moment, Representative Lesh. There, you know, the rulemaking language in here is on line 9.10, 9.11. It's pretty standard. It says the commissioner may adopt rules to carry out the purposes of this section. Like, we can't exactly speculate about what every rule could possibly involve. I think it's our job to determine whether or not the rulemaking language in here is sufficient to give the agency, you know, sufficient notice about what they might need to do when, you know, the time comes after the law's been in effect, and it's determined what sorts of questions, what sorts of guidance is necessary from the agency. If every bill that involves rulemaking, we spend lots of the committee time trying to anticipate what might happen, I don't think we will be passing many bills. But Representative Lesh, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I've built one business and sold it, and I'm building another business, and I've used QuickBooks. QuickBooks has that feature. Okay, I mean, any system that you have to track payment and benefits has that feature. Doesn't matter if it's less than 2 hours a week or anything else. I don't think that it will be that difficult to track if you're working 80 hours a year.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the reason why I'm referencing things that are defined is the definitions that are put in the bill, no matter what section the definition is, apply to and are utilized by the entire in every section within the bill. And therefore, I thought that we're using definitions, that it would be fair to ask and try and reference to that, because the first thing that the agency, I would assume, do is actually look at what is defined within the bill to be able to implement and do the rulemaking. Now, the reason why I'm hitting on the example I am is because we have a problem with daycare providers staying in business, and anything that increases the burden upon them. And that's why I'm trying to have an understanding, because the rulemaking is often say, well, that's rulemaking. But that is a huge burden to some of the people. And being able to understand and have a testifier that can tell us, we've got the similar system, it's got a slightly different definition of employee or et cetera, but, it adds some comfort having a testifier that could sort of address some of those, so we'd have confidence. And if there isn't a system existing, would there be any software, any additional type stuff that would have to be implemented to do that? So that is dependent upon how the rulemaking and implementation of the bill is. So that's why I'm asking.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I mean, an additional point I'll make about this is that this isn't expedited rulemaking. This is the standard rulemaking that is the most transparent and has an opportunity for public comment too. So if there are any concerns that come out during when there is a proposed rule, the agency can respond to those as well. Representative Zerwa?
Mr. Chair,
yes,
just in closing on that point, is frankly, I'd like to be able to be informed when I vote and not say, you won't know exactly how this is implemented until, you know, months and years later.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Quam. Again, I'll just reiterate the whole purpose of rulemaking in general. Like, I guess, just to take a step back here, you know, when we started out this committee, I generally, you know, didn't have any super visionary impact, you know, sense of what this committee might do. It is, you know, we hear lots of bills in this committee, and, you know, there are a lot, just because lots of bills have provisions about rulemaking. So I generally bypassed the, you know, the overviews that so many other committees are having. But I did feel like one overview that was important to have was to have House Research explain the rulemaking process to us and what it's used for. Like, we will not be able to anticipate every situation in every bill that a rulemaking provision will have, and I don't think it's necessarily fair. I understand it would be nice to know every situation that might occur in the future, and it would give people comfort to do that. But part of the reason we have a rulemaking process in place is just to, is for unanticipated situations. So, you know, maybe at some point it would be good to have additional discussion about rulemaking in this committee, just kind of in general. But we do have another bill on the agenda with many more testifiers than there are on this one. So I would like to get to that as quickly as possible out of respect for them. Representative Zerwas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, question for the testifier from the department. In the amendment that was adopted, in both Subdivision 2 and in Subdivision 10, the fine amounts are increased from $1,000 to $10,000. Just wondering if that new fine amount of $10,000 is in line with fines for other violations that the department would oversee and implement.
Ms. Peruschek.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, the decision to increase the level of penalty is a policy decision, but well, the department is working on other legislation to increase the penalty that is pending before the governor's office for review.
Representative Zerwas.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess it's an answer. It's just not an answer to the question I asked. Is this in line with other, you have a fee schedule, a fine schedule within the department for other violations that employers might face? Is this $10,000 fine? And in Subdivision 7, where it's $10,000 fine for each violation for each employee, which could easily be $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 in fines, are those fine amounts in line with the fee schedule in the department?
Ms. Peruschek, and I don't know if Representative Lesh or Mr. Elliott has any comments about this either.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, the current level of penalty is $1,000, and the bill is proposing to increase that to $10,000. So that's existing law versus what is being proposed. Chapter 177 does provide when there are violations that the department can assess penalties for requiring back wages be paid and liquidated damages as well.
Representative Lesh, or Representative Zerwas, I do notice it's up to, the amount is up to, so it's not a mandatory fine. So, but Representative Zerwas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to the author, what was the intent of increasing the maximum fine tenfold?
Well, okay, Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, part of the incentive was the math done by Representative Nash. If you wanted to be a scofflaw company, you could just pull the Ford pinhole method and say, well, costs less for us to violate and pay out on this than it does to protect people. And at $1,000 a pop, there might be a perverse incentive to do that. If you recall Ford Pinto, they knew their little cars were blowing up from where the gas tank was, and they said, well, we'll pay out on the lawsuits from people cooking alive in barbecues rather than do a national recall that would cost more and protect individual safety. So the idea is that to remove that perverse incentive to damage people, we needed $10,000.
And just so members are aware, too, and members of the public, I want to mention, we do have another bill on the agenda. We will likely go past our regular scheduled committee ending time of 11:15. We can go potentially as late as 12:30. I know there was an email that went out that said that that is a possibility. If necessary, we can reconvene tonight. We do have a committee room reserved. It will be at the call of a chair. At the call of the chair, I know there are other committee hearings happening as well as field hearings. So it is possible it will be late, potentially after the field hearing has happened. But if necessary, that is what we will do. So Representative Zerwas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being so flexible with the schedule as we debate these pretty significant bills. Just final comment. Representative Lesh, you, of course, didn't mean to equate business owners in Minnesota with a company that knowingly cooked their consumers and their cars, did you? You probably didn't mean to say that or infer that.
Well, quick response, Representative Lesh. It sounded like it might have been more of a...
You probably didn't.
Was that an analogy, Mr. Chair, of the incentives of a company to violate one of the most glaring examples, which was Ford in the 1970s? So, no, I don't think any Minnesota employers want to cook people in cars.
Representative Okay. All right. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike. Concern starts with line 2.19, where it says that a family member is up to one individual annually designated by the employee. So I'm assuming that every employee would be eligible for this because they could have they could designate somebody that they know as a family member. So my comments kind of go back to that premise. These are to Department of Labor and Industry. Because if you look, the enactment, the effective date of this is 180 days after enactment, 6 months. Representative Nash talked about the financial implications. Anybody that's familiar with audits knows that a company has to recognize their liabilities on their books properly. Otherwise, they're not going to get a clean opinion. This could affect the way people are going to have to recognize things on their books because they're going to have to know what their potential liability is, and I'm talking about every employee in the company. So therefore, when we go to 4.27, and it says the employer may require notice, which is either foreseeable or unforeseeable, I'm wondering of the persons at Department of Labor and Industry, how's that going to be defined? Because again, a lot of these things are going to need to be defined, and we're talking about a rather lengthy rulemaking process. Are you going to be able to define this in time so that when the enactment date happens, the companies will have a clear understanding of what foreseeable and unforeseeable are so that they know exactly how much they have to accrue as a liability?
Who would like to take the question?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
It's not within Article 2. Representative Vogel did ask the department representative how it could be implemented. I'd ask that you not require her to speculate, but if she has an example, that might be an appropriate response of what they've done before.
Ms. Peruzek?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we would certainly be open to working with the author to refine the definitions in the bill. Otherwise, we could go through the rulemaking process to provide that clarity.
Okay, Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do feel it's pertinent because we are talking about rulemaking in Article 2, and this goes back to what's needed to be done with the rulemaking process relative to the other things in the bill. If we go to 5.16, it talks about smallest increment. Again, how is a company going, what type of rules are you going to come out that will define clearly for the company that they'll know what is going to be considered their smallest increment? They may have an internal system that's asking for production times, and you keep track of your time in 5-minute increments because that's the way the cost structure is. Is that the way it's going to be done, or are you going to look at something else? Again, looking at, we only have 6 months to not only get the rules defined but implemented in these companies.
Representative Vogel, I'll allow some leeway, but as I said earlier, we cannot speculate as to everything that might become necessary as this law is implemented to determine what rulemaking might need. Otherwise, we will spend a lot of time here. The purpose of rulemaking, again, I would just like to reiterate, is to determine things that are, you know, that possibly are unforeseen at the time and to provide clarity. But we can't anticipate every situation where that might occur. I don't want our testifiers to feel they have to keep repeating the same response just because they can't anticipate everything. But do you have Mr. Elliott or Ms. Peruschek any comment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just say, like, I don't, as an author, I don't necessarily have a problem with committee members speculating on what could happen. I object to committee members asking testifiers to speculate on various things. I think that's inappropriate. It's out of the box. However, I would ask Mr. Elliott if he could make a statement on this.
Sure. The answer. Mr. Elliott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is based on the experience we've had in the states and municipalities that have passed earned sick and sick time, including 11 states and just in Minnesota, 3 municipalities. The smallest increment is intended to basically say if you are paid in 15-minute increments, you should be able to use your sick time in the increments in which you are paid.
Okay, thank you. We are moving a little bit outside of the scope of this committee's jurisdiction. Representative Vogel, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair, because I do feel this is pertinent because we also have to be cognizant of the effective date of this legislation and the time the employers are going to need to be able to react to it. And therefore, I realize that we're restricted to Article 2, but these things that are in Article 1 are going to be they're going to have to be addressed, and they're going to have to be addressed in time so that employers can make financial decisions relative to their balance sheet and income statement. So either we should be talking about an extended time, or Department of Labor Industry should already have been aware of this and working on it, because how are they going to get this out in time? If you give an employer at 175 days the rules that are going to be promulgated, that means they've got 5 days to restate their income statement and balance sheet relative to the rules that have just been put upon them, because we're setting new benefits. And that's the reason for my questions.
Okay. Thank you. I didn't, for the statement of the reasoning for your questions. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll defer to your opinion whether or not this is in the committee's purview, being new here, just in also an employee and employer in the asphalt industry. I've done a lot of snow removal, and my question just had to do with if I could direct your attention to 4.20, 4.19 and 4.20, closure of employees' place of business due to weather or other public emergency, or an employee's need to care for a family member whose school or place of care has been closed due to weather. I mean, specifically when it comes to, is if I'm just looking at this as a possible unintended consequence where we're in a very busy time of snow removal right now, for example, and say you had a family member that was in a care facility, and that employee, I could see a scenario where the employee maybe says, hey, I can't come into work because I have to go take care of a kid or plant, you know, something that's worthy of that, but and then possibly facing whatever the definition of retaliation is, maybe from the employer, because in the snow removal industry, you do need employees to show up to plow out places like schools and care facilities. And so is this, I'm just kind of concerned about unintended consequence there, if it could be looked at as retaliation where employer might tell employee, hey, at the end of the day, I need you to show up to plow, and if you can't, we have to find somebody that can, because we have to plow out these important facilities. So I guess that's my question for Representative Lesh, and I just mean to be brief. And again, I apologize if it's a little outside the purview.
It is outside of the question of the agency purview. Representative Lesh, do you have a quick comment to that?
I'd be brief in response, Mr. Chair, and Representative Heinrich. One of the most beneficial aspects of this bill is that caregiving can be spread across multiple caregivers. Okay, so when this law is implemented statewide, and if you can't get out because your boss runs the plowing company, you got to be there to plow, your spouse can do it, or another caregiver could do it, as defined in the definition section. That's why this is going to protect workers who need that time off, is because it spreads out that caregiving responsibility, and you can still go to work because someone else can take care of your kid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh.
Okay, Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for the author, Representative Lesh. My understanding, you know, we've been discussing here the fact that there are several cities that already have this or some version of this, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Duluth. Oftentimes, these things bubble up from the local level, and if they're successful, they're adopted at the state level. My question is, how does this differ from, say, what Minneapolis has right now? And so it's kind of a three-part question. How does it differ? And if it does, you know, why not just take something from Minneapolis? And then if you're an employer and you're in Minneapolis and you're already operating with this program, how do you work into this new plan?
Representative Lehman, that's also a little outside, but if you have a quick response.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the quickest response could probably be provided by Mr. Elliott, okay, who's worked with those ordinances.
Sure. Mr. Elliott?
Sure. The primary difference between this bill and the ordinances, which of course also do have subtle differences, but the primary difference is simply the enforcement authority, which is in the purview of this committee, simply because the state has different enforcement authority than cities do. And that's that. Otherwise, it tracks with what was passed very closely in each of the three cities.
Okay. Representative Lehman?
And does that also include the penalty, the higher penalties?
Mr. Elliott.
Again, the state has different enforcement authority, and so the state also has different maximums on what they can incur as penalties than the cities do. The cities have different limits.
Representative Lehman.
Okay. So just the final question is, so if this is adopted, then Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth would need to obviously make those adjustments.
Mr. Elliott.
In terms of the enforcement, the cities would not need to make adjustments. Their enforcement authority would be independent of the state's enforcement authority.
So they retain...
Representative Lehman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the local cities would retain their enforcement ability.
Mr. Elliott.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do want to preface this, if you know, to provide me some latitude. Just my comments and questions are response to the discussion that I've been hearing too, and to the testifiers, what we're hearing over here at the table, or what I'm hearing, is that we're hearing about the perspective of the employers, and we're not hearing about the workers. And I know that, Mr. Chair, you have closed public testimony, and so if I may ask, Mr. Elliott, can you just provide us, you know, what is the workers' perspective as to why we need to pursue this for the workers of Minnesota?
Representative Lee, I'll allow a little latitude, but I have been pointing out to the other side that their questions, when they've exceeded the jurisdiction of this committee, that they do so. But Representative Elliott, if you could be brief, this is kind of outside of the agency, this committee's jurisdiction.
Understood. Representative Lee, Mr. Chair, simply put, workers are having to face the decision between their paycheck and caring for themselves and loved ones. We know that, for example, a worker is 52% more likely to take a day off when they are sick if that day would be paid. This provides protection to employees who need to care for their children, their parents, their loved ones, themselves, without fearing reprisal, retaliation, loss of employment, or loss of a paycheck for doing that. And as a result, people are able to actually take the time to care for themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just bringing it back to the rulemaking piece, to Ms. Prushak, can you describe what is the process in place to ensure that workers and employees in the state of Minnesota have a voice in the rulemaking process so that they can see the protection that are being implemented in this bill?
Ms. Perushek, I could also hand this one to Mr. Gehring, who is an expert in the rulemaking process, but if you would like to comment.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, as the Chair had stated, this is the regular rulemaking process. There will be an opportunity for public comment, and we will welcome the opportunity to hear from workers and employers on the rulemaking that will best suit their needs.
Okay, Representative Lee.
Just a final comment, Mr. Chair. And I really hope that the agencies will do their part in really reaching out to, community members who will, really benefit from this protection that may not even know about the rulemaking process. And I can say that from the constituents that I represent in my district, where a lot of them are service members, but I don't think that they understand or know what is the process in place and, really protecting them when they're getting out there to do their job that, they're doing just to make a living. So really encourage you to do your part to reach out to our community members.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I'm hearing is a lot of fear about how this will, this policy will affect business without kind of the facts that are out there. There's been research from the National Partnership of Women and Families that has looked at a lot of these policies around the country, and there's a growing body of evidence that the paid sick days makes business and economic sense. San Francisco, 70% of employers reported no effect on profitability. Washington, D.C., no evidence that the law prompted businesses to leave the city or discouraged employers from establishing new businesses in it. Connecticut, Seattle, Jersey, New York City, a lot of these there's just no facts to back up the fact that this isn't good for business. In fact, Jim Lazareth, the senior vice president for policy in the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce, said the impact of San Francisco's law on employers minimal, and by and large, this has not been an employer issue. San Francisco's economy is booming, so the facts are there to back it up that this is good for business, this is good for employers and employees. And I just really want to thank you, Representative Lesh, for bringing this forward.
I don't have any additional members on the list. So, seeing none, Representative Lesh, would you, Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We would ask for a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Lesh, do you have any closing remarks?
Thank you, I would, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate everyone who came up to testify on this, both for and against. I would note the irony, Ms. Chair and members, completely respecting the folks who came in opposition, but every person who came up and testified in opposition represents a non-profit entity. Now, let the irony of that sink in for a second, okay? They do not pay the taxes. They use the resources, infrastructure, and services, and the rest of us pay for that. I checked on. They're a 501c6. I looked online while he was talking. The issue is, listen, everyone wants what's theirs, and they don't want to share. It's human nature. There's no question about it. But a lot of times when we foment a policy like this, and we ensure that no matter where you live, your job, your color, your skin, or the differences you may have, it benefits all of us together. And that goes to the statement that Representative Cagle was just talking about. We want to be able to snuggle our kids when they're sick to make them feel better. You want to see your doctor before your illness goes from bad to worse, to be able to recover from the flu without missing bills or losing your job. So this is about moving forwards together to create the kind of Minnesota that we all want to be. And there won't be, I think, the negative repercussions as suggested. I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. A roll call has been requested. So the clerk will take the roll. I will renew my motion that House File 11, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Representative Gomez.
Yes.
Representative Cagle.
Yes.
Representative Lee.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski. Representative Sauk.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
Representative Heinrich.
No.
Representative Lehman.
No.
Representative Nash.
Nope.
Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Tice.
No.
Representative Vogel.
No.
Representative West.
There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion is adopted. The bill is moved on. Thank you for your patience, Representative Halverson. While you're getting your materials ready, I do want to mention to members, I think we will be able to get this done before, without a need for recess. If necessary, we can reconvene, but it will likely not be until 9 p.m. The Transportation Committee is scheduled to be done at 8:30. There are several members of both sides on that committee. So I would, out of respect for that committee and the meeting there, so I will likely not reconvene this meeting until then. If necessary, I will be a little more rigid about the two-minute time limit on this one as well. Thank you, everybody in the audience, for your patience on this. So Representative Halverson, again, thank you for your patience. I will move that House File 5 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and I understand you have an amendment also, Representative Halverson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's an author's amendment.
Okay, it's marked A5. This would put the bill into the shape that the author would like. It's in members' packets. Is there any discussion? Okay, all those in favor of the A5 amendment, please say, yes, Representative Zerwas.
Just wondering if either Representative Halverson or if non-partisan could walk through the amendment. It is pretty substantive, and it's not a full DE, so just for making sure that members are able to track, that would be helpful on our
Representative Halverson, would it be your preference? You know, it is pretty standard practice, Representative Zerwas, to allow the author some leeway in putting the bill in the shape they would like, but if Representative Halverson or non-partisan House Research, yes, Representative Zerwas?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that this isn't the first committee that the bill has been heard in, and so this is multiple attempts to get the bill in the way they want. I understand with an author's amendment in the first committee hearing, but general practice around here is by the second or third committee hearing, if you're going to make substantive changes that would change a House research summary from one committee to the next, that those changes would be covered. I'd appreciate it if they were covered.
I don't know if Mr. Gehring or Mr. Weeks, I don't know whose preference it would be. Please provide a short summary.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, I'm not going to go in order of the amendment because some of the changes are throughout, but I'll go through the high-level changes. One notable change is that under the current version of the bill, there's a concept of covered business entities, which are businesses that have 50% or more of their workforce being 1099 contractors are currently treated as employees under the bill. That concept's removed. So this bill would only cover now, if it was amended, traditional employees. And that change is mainly on 1.19 through 1.21 of the amendment. The bill, though, does now include a definition of what would count as an independent contractor, and that's at 2.1 through 2.2. There is, throughout the bill, based on some recommendations from the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, the Department of Labor and Industry was more specifically included, for instance, in data sharing that had, under the current version of the bill, only been with DEED, can now be DEED or Department of Labor and Industry in order for them to use their enforcement authority under the bill. And then if you look at 3.15 to 3.27 in the bill, that's some clarification about both an employee's right to leave that is associated with an employee's right to benefits under the bill and clarifies some of the notice that an employee would have to give to the employer. And then there's some small technical changes throughout, mostly dealing with including Dolly, where it had mostly been DEED before. And then another large change on 5.14 through the end of page 5, or at 6.2, rather, is the inclusion of a concept of small business assistant grants. And that's based on something that was included in Washington State's program, and that says that employers with 50 or fewer employees can apply to the Department of Employment and Economic Development for relatively small money grants for hiring replacement workers for workers who are on leave under the program.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. With that understanding, I will renew my motion that the author's amendment be adopted. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. People need to get more into these voice votes. Representative Halverson, could you please explain your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief as I know that the purview of this committee is not broad, but I will also, and this is our third stop of six, I believe, and the first thing I will say is the amendment process has been very robust with this bill because my job has been meeting with stakeholders to hear input, and the grant program that Mr. Weeks mentioned actually came directly from a meeting that I had with a group of business leaders that were here visiting the Capitol, and somebody brought that idea forward. We went searching for language, found it, and it is in the bill. So this will not be the last author's amendment that this bill will see because every committee hearing the feedback, we continue to work on this bill. The goal is to get a paid family leave program available to all Minnesota employers and employees who need to take leave to deal with a complicated pregnancy, a medical issue, or to care for a loved one. We have been very clear from the beginning that this is not a bill that is designed to in any way punish or push employers. What we are being asked for by small employers is a way for them to compete for employees in the tight economic job market that we're sitting in right now. About 14% of people in the United States are the lucky ones. They have access to paid family and medical leave through their employers. Minnesota's top largest employers tend to offer this benefit very generously, and many of them offer this benefit not only in Minnesota, but in states around the country that have also adopted paid family and medical leave. So this is a system that is working throughout the states. What we are doing with this bill is creating a fund that employers can provide to employees paid family medical leave. Now, this is not extra leave. This is not vacation. This is not anything that's taken willy-nilly. There are standards in the bill for the application process, for certification by medical professionals, and approval by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. There is also oversight and provided by the Department of Labor and Industry. And that was what brings us to your committee, Mr. Chair. There is rulemaking that is part of this bill. We are modeling this benefit on the unemployment insurance benefit that has existed in Minnesota for 80 years. So when it comes to the rulemaking and the oversight of this, that is the model that we are using. So it is far from a brand new territory in the state of Minnesota. We know that life happens to Minnesotans. Women are required by their doctors to go on bed rest in order to maintain a healthy pregnancy. Women give birth and need time to bond with their new baby. Dads need time to bond with their new babies. We have sick parents. You may have a loved one who is spending time in hospice. You may have a loved one who is suddenly taken ill in an accident and is in ICU. These are the situations that we're talking about. Having leave available to people doesn't make people use leave more. It does tend to make people do these things. It makes people engage in the employment market when they otherwise might not, and it makes sure that employees who are tied to an employer at the time, it makes it much more likely that after this kind of a situation in their lives, they're going to come back to that employer. So it does a lot to help with our workforce issues. With that, Mr. Chair, I will just stop with that brief overview and allow testifiers to have the floor.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Halverson. And just to build on the point you mentioned about what's in the committee's jurisdiction, I do think it's a little more than the rulemaking likely. There is the whole issue of a substantial change to the powers and duties of an agency. I think that might span sections 6 through 27 of Article 1. There is, though, specific rulemaking authority on lines 9.9 to 9.10 of the bill. So, I know Representative Zerwas is always very eager to point out the substantial change to an agency. Yeah, and there's a provision dealing with IT on lines 9.14 to 9.15. I will go to testimony. I should have offered, I did notice a couple people who were on the list for House File 5 who were also on the list for House File 11. Since I gave a couple people the opportunity to get it out of the way earlier, I think I should at least offer, I apologize to them for not providing them that offer. I didn't notice they were on the list for both, but I think I'll let them go first. So Danny Schwartzman, are you still here? Thank you for your patience. So.
So, again, I'm Danny Schwartzman. I own Common Roots Cafe and Common Roots Catering in Minneapolis. I employ approximately 50 people, and I'm here today because I'm excited to support the paid family medical leave bill. For me, I think there's a reasonable question many representatives have brought up about, I think, about the question of government's role in business, I think. And I think the very, very basic role that government can have is help to set the bar at a reasonably high level so that we have the basic working conditions we want all people in our state to see. And with this, I think, as a parent, I have a five-month-old now who kept me up much of last night. I know well the challenges. I also have a five-year-old. So I know well the challenges that my employees face and that people in our community face and the really critical importance of people having the time they need to spend time with their children, have the time right after their kids are born to spend their time with their families. And I also know the pressures that so many in our state are under, especially those working in low-wage industries like restaurants, and I'm a low-wage employer, relatively. I employ my staff at $15 an hour or more, but still, that's a pretty low wage. And they have to choose every day about what kinds of things they're going to spend money on. And you don't want that financial consideration to become in the way of being able to spend time with a newborn child. And I've watched that happen. We've offered 2 weeks as a benefit, which is something we've been able to do as an extra benefit. It's not something the market requires in low-wage industries. There's not sufficient demand. It's not forced on employers. But I think most employers and most people in the state would love to see everyone have access to a basic amount of leave around these kinds of basic issues. And with this bill and this system, we'd have the opportunity to have a state-run system that at very low cost and very easy infrastructure on the employer side can provide this kind of benefit to so many people. And that's not something that we can easily access without this kind of government program. There's simply not an option that is easy to administer. So I'm really excited to have this option. I think it'll make a real difference in our community, and I don't think it'll be that challenging for anyone to administer.
Thank you. You were exactly 2 minutes. I have two testifiers who I would like to give the opportunity to speak, and then I will.
It's just to him.
Yes, I understand that, Representative Quam. However, I have one testifier I've been told has to leave. It is, in fact, the commissioner of Dolly. And Mr. Schwartzman, if you could just stick around for a few more minutes, there might be a question specifically for you. Yes, welcome to the committee, and I will hold you to the same 2 minutes.
All right.
Your title notwithstanding.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Steve Grove. I'm the Commissioner of Deed, and I'm thrilled to be here this morning. This is a big idea, an important idea, that can really distance Minnesota's economy from other state economies and help us close that talent gap that we have here in the state. As we all know, we've got about 140,000 open jobs in the state and about 80,000 people looking for jobs. So we've got about 0.6 workers for every open job that we have. And a big part of that is making Minnesota a really attractive place to work. And that means allowing people that has the benefits they need to live life and work at the same time. About 1 in 10 Minnesotans every year have to leave work for a period of time to take care of a loved one or a new child. And about a quarter of them don't get paid anything at all for that period of time. And so we need to target this population really, really specifically. I myself, before I came into government just a few weeks ago, worked at Google. The company has a great paid family medical leave program. 2 years ago, my wife and I had twins, and we both were able to take advantage of that program and take some time with our little ones in those early days. Everyone in this room has a story of a time when life happened to you and you had to figure out a way to navigate. Hopefully, you find a way to still get paid, but for a lot of Minnesotans, it's difficult. It's easy for big companies like Google to create these programs. It's much harder for smaller businesses. So the model here that Representative Halverson has designed with consultation from experts across the country, Washington, California, New Jersey in particular come to mind, states that have really distanced themselves in programs like these, use this payroll tax element to get it right. I'm here from Deed because Deed would administer this program. We have a UI program, as you all know, that we run on a similar model of using an insurance pool pulled in from a payroll tax. The amount of money we've set aside to build the system here is $68 million. That's what's in the governor's budget. That's to build the technical infrastructure to take in that tax money and pay for this program and to staff up those original year. But once the program's underway, it will pay for itself by the payroll tax itself. And so we've done all the calculations to figure out what it takes to get this off and running and are excited to do that with your help. I think the details around the benefit package and the bill itself are placeholder in the governor's budget for now. We're looking forward to working with you on them and are excited to be here. So thanks for having me.
Thank you for your keeping your testimony brief, Commissioner. Representative Quam, would you like me to call Mr. Schwartzman back?
Well, Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to...
If you could keep it very brief, I want to make sure everyone
who's come here has the opportunity to testify. The specific question is during the testifying, was he said basic benefits, and looking at this bill, I see it adds up 12 weeks plus 12 weeks is 24 weeks, and since he was testifying for basic, I was wondering if 24 weeks is considered basic benefits.
Mr. Schwartzman?
I can answer that, too.
I think you're referring to the option of stacking medical leave and parental leave, and that's how you get into 24 weeks, and I think that's a relatively unlikely situation to come up. I think there's a lot of benefits that you imagine, you budget, that people are going to use all of them, but people don't always use all of them. As a parent, I think 3 months goes remarkably fast. I would think that's a very reasonable basic level of time to make sure someone has to spend with a newborn child. I think that's a great level, an affordable level, and I think by spreading the pool over the entire state, I think there's economics of scale that we simply don't have as a 50-employee small business. So I think that's a basic benefit, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartzman. The next testifier I'd like to call is Stephanie Menning from the Utility Contractors Association. And I apologize for not giving you the opportunity to speak on the first bill.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't go through my spiel again, except for I would like to make a clarification on Representative Lesh's statement about being a nonprofit.
If you could please, allow some leeway, but
I represent the 130 businesses that are for-profit and employ thousands of people in Minnesota. The nonprofit is here on their behalf.
Okay. Thank you.
I just want to point out that most employers would prefer to operate their business in freedom. 24 weeks is the entirety of the construction season here in Minnesota. There has to be some leeway with this bill. And I also would like to just note that the spirit of competition upon which this country was founded and within which innovation and creativity flourish diminish every time government steps into business. Thank you.
Okay. If you could hold on a second. Is this do you have a quote, Ms. Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair, to this statement that construction season only lasts 24 weeks. I worked in the construction industry for over 40 years, and I was only off a month and a half in 40 years. We worked in the winter, we work in the summer, we work year-round. So I know there are some industries that, like road construction, that do have to slow down a lot in the winter, but for the most part, the construction industry is a year-round industry and not just 12 weeks.
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification.
Chair, Representative
Ms. Menning.
The folks I represent are engaged in sewer and water. You can only go dig so deep in the frost. They are.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. I have next testifier I have is Chris Liefeld from the Department of Labor and Industry. Okay. I'm going to be really embarrassed if I mispronounced your name because I have the same two vowels in the same order in my last name. But let me know if I'm right. Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Chris Liefeld.
Very good.
And I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm happy to be here today to speak in support of House File 5, a bill to create a paid family medical leave insurance program in Minnesota. Paid family leave is an important part of the governor's budget and represents Minnesota's commitment to the prosperity of our state's families and communities. Establishing a paid family medical leave benefit will create a strong foundation for the health and well-being of the families in our state. The Department of Labor and Industry will be responsible for ensuring that Minnesotans have access to this important benefit. The department will have primary enforcement responsibility for this legislation and work to protect workers from retaliation from using needed leave. In addition, the department will play a key role in raising awareness about the program, educating workers and employers about this new benefit. As you know, any worker can experience an event in their lives when they need to take time away from work to care for a new baby, elderly parent, or to recover from one's own serious health condition. Many Minnesotans simply can't afford to take an unpaid leave when tending to these needs. The department is committed to continuing to work with the authors as this bill moves through the committee process, and we are excited to be part of this very important initiative. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier I have on the list is Stephanie Myers. And then after that, it's Laura Kushner from the League of Minnesota Cities. So if you could just come down to be ready to speak, that would be great. Welcome to the committee. If you could please just identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure thing. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Meyer, and I'm a Mendota Heights mother of four children, and I'm a proud member of the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. I was part of the 2016 movement in my union that secured 6 weeks of paid leave for new birth or adoptive parents who work in state government. I know the difference it makes to have access to paid time off. Not long after the paid parental leave program began, our little girl Penny was born. And though I had saved up my sick time, the additional 6 weeks of paid leave allowed for quality bonding time with my daughter without having to stress about lost income. I still remember when our first child, Jude, was born, and I didn't know how we were going to make everything work. I didn't know how I was going to be able to keep my job and handle a newborn, and then the nurse put him in my arms, and they were telling me and my husband that we could go home. And the thought crosses your mind, how are they possibly sending me home with a tiny human? I can't even keep a houseplant alive. But you work hard and you figure it out, but it's not easy. And we can find ways to make it easier for each other, and paid leave makes it a little bit easier. I'm here today because I believe if the state can figure out how to offer 6 weeks of paid parental leave to state employees, we can work together to implement a paid family and medical leave program for all Minnesotans. The state recognized that in order to recruit and retain top talent, it needs to offer competitive benefits like paid parental leave. Creating a program that gives Minnesotans access to paid time off to care for a loved one in any phase of life is the right way to do business and the right thing for our communities. Through political and professional will, we can work together to make this happen. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Meyer. Apparently... Ms. Kushner is not here, so I will move to Debbie Erickson. Says, along with Andy Loken, I don't know if you both want to come down together. Are you also here? Okay, I'm not seeing them. The next on the list that I have is Megan Peterson. Welcome to the committee. If you could please just state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Certainly. Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Megan Peterson, and I'm here today to testify in support of House File 5. I'm doing so as a mother, as a co-parent, as a member of the LGBTQ community, and as the executive director of Gender Justice, a nonprofit advocacy organization based here in St. Paul. I'd like to share with you my personal story to illustrate why the bill's inclusive definition of family is so important. The family definition recognizes the various ways Minnesotans build their families. In fact, it would include mine, while a narrower definition would not. 7.5 years ago, my partner, Wen Broveld, and I were overjoyed to welcome our son, Elias Scott. For the last 4 years, Wen and I have been committed and loving co-parents, living separately, but maintaining a healthy, mutually supportive co-parent relationship. Wen's family of origin does not live in Minnesota, and if Wen were to face a serious illness and needs caretaking support, I will be there. It is reasonable to imagine, for the sake of our family and for the continued health of our son as well, including his financial health, I would need to take a paid leave from work. the paid family medical leave program would support us through a challenging time without having to face a financial disaster for our family. Gwen and I are not married. We are not related by blood, and yet we are without question each other's family. We are part of each other's chosen family. Respecting chosen family is critical for the equality of LGBTQ people in particular, who are more likely to experience estrangement from their families of origin. As Executive Director of Gender Justice, I am also an employer at a small nonprofit. I wholeheartedly endorse this bill because it will help me afford to offer paid leave to my employees. It will also help me to attract and retain the employees we need to meet our mission. And speaking of our mission, which is to advance gender equity through the law, Gender Justice also supports paid family medical leave because it contributes to gender equity in the workplace and at home. Paid family medical leave supports mothers to remain in the workforce, helps to reduce the pay gap, and also helps to break down outdated gender roles by equally supporting men as fathers and caregivers. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to the important role paid family medical leave serves to expand gender equity.
Thank you for your testimony. And I understand that the League of Minnesota Cities, who I called on earlier, have submitted a letter that's in your packets, but are here to answer questions but don't need to testify specifically. Next on the list is Keith Carlson. Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 14 of the state's larger counties. First, I want to indicate I want to thank the author, Representative Halverson, for meeting with me and having addressed some of our concerns in earlier hearings on this bill. I do still have significant concerns, though, on behalf of counties. One would be obvious that we're, in effect, paying twice. We already provide generous benefits to our employees, and with the payroll tax or premiums under this bill, we will be paying again to provide leave for other employers' employees. Local government costs will be substantial under this bill. At the 0.31% rate that we understand would be necessary to implement this, it will cost local governments $34 million and cost our employees an equivalent amount. We will probably pace for that amount in increased settlements at the bargaining table. We already provide most of the leaves contemplated under this bill, 12 weeks of pregnancy and parenting leave under MS-181-941, care for the sick or injured relatives under 181.9413, and up to four weeks of safety leave for victims of sexual assault or domestic abuse or stalking under current state law. We are concerned with the potential stacking of benefits. The 24 weeks issue has already been identified in many other testifiers' handouts and testimony. We believe that because we have incurred the cost for providing paid leave for our employees, that they should be required to take that leave first before taking the leave under this bill. We've taken that into account in our staffing levels. This adds a new nuance to what we will have to do to maintain our staffing, particularly for those functions that are 24/7 for them.
If you could please wrap up your testimony.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, we do want to mention we have substantial concerns about the reinstatement after leave provisions. It will be particularly problematic for us with regards to our seasonal temps. I will mention that on the amendment
quickly.
On line 2.25, I think there's a mistake. The deletion of lines 9 and 10 on page 9 deletes the rulemaking authority. So I think that's an inaccurate reference, but maybe it's intended.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carlson, for your testimony. Representative Nash, is your question for this testifier specifically?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is.
Okay. If you could make it quick, just to make sure there are other
people. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, if counties are to pay for this twice, or local unit of government are going to pay this twice,
How are they going to accommodate that that double payment? What are they going to have to do in order to come up with that revenue?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nash, we will have to raise property taxes or cut our costs.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Halverson, did you have a comment?
I do have a comment because the bill is very clear that nobody who offers a private plan does pay twice. You are not assessed a premium if you offer if an employer offers their own private plan. And as Mr. Carlson described, based on what the county offers, the county would simply apply to Deed to let Deed know what their current plan is, and Deed would give the authority, and there would be a small fee assessed for the application, but it is not a premium that is paid annually. That was actually changed in the last stop.
Okay. Representative Nash, are you done?
Mr. Chair, in the essence of time, I would like to hear from Mr. Carlson on his opinion of that retort.
Okay, Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, members, although our leaves are generous, three counties currently offer up to 3 weeks for parenting or maternity leave. They do not match the requirements of this bill of up to 12 weeks of family leaves, up to 12 weeks of medical benefits leave, and consequently could not qualify for the credit that Representative Halverson referred to.
Okay, Representative
Nash. Mr. Chair, very briefly, so that in actuality would increase levy issues for counties that don't qualify in what you just articulated. Correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative okay. Nash, we would have to recover our costs somehow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, yes.
Representative
Nash.
In anticipation of a vote pending, we'd like to roll call this. Thank you.
That would be fine. A roll call has been requested to the court. Representative Quam, did you have a question for this testifier specifically? I'd like to make sure we have time.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted clarification so that if they utilize some of their existing benefit, they don't get partial credit. So it's either it doesn't count. And then also clarification: we deleted rulemaking? Is it no longer in the purview of this committee, and we should not be hearing this bill?
Representative Quam, to your second point, it is possible that there was a typo in the amendment, and nonpartisan staff is currently addressing that. When they've told me how they would suggest proceeding with that, I will discuss with the committee how that issue should be addressed. To the first question, which I don't even remember anymore, Mr. Carlson, if you could answer whatever it was, that would be great.
Mr. Chairman, this bill, as it stands right now, does not give credit for the paid leave against the financial obligations, the premiums of this, if it does not meet the duration and amount that's required under this bill.
Okay. Thank you. So I don't have anybody else on the list, but I would like to see a show of hands if there's anybody in the audience. I'm talking about testimony. I'll get to member questions then, too. So is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify on this? Okay. I'm not seeing any, so I will go to member discussion.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. I was too busy looking to the sides. I didn't even see you coming to the front. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, this is Deb Fitzpatrick. I'll let her introduce herself, but she is here for technical assistance. Ms. Fitzpatrick facilitated and completed the study that was brought forward under Minnesota law in order to study how Minnesota could create a paid family leave program. So it is her research which has helped facilitate the creation of this bill, and she is here for technical assistance.
Okay, thank you. So sounds like Ms. Fitzpatrick, sounds like you don't need to testify, but you're there if necessary. So members, discussion. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, line 9.14 or 1.5. Information technology services and equipment, you're exempting the department from doing this. Is there a, you know, reason that you don't want Minute to come up with IT services? I'm just probing, questioning. I'm a curious guy on IT issues, as you know, but is it because they are miserably failing at things, or could you maybe elucidate on that for us?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, the language is in the bill simply to provide the departments the ability to create the program as they see fit and their flexibility in order to create a program that is effective and cost-effective.
So, Representative Nash.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Would that then be possibly provided by an outside private vendor, or how do you envision that?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, I envision giving the department the authority that it needs in order to complete the task that's outlined in the bill.
Representative Nash.
We'll deal with that on the floor maybe later. We'll have fun.
Okay, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have some questions in regards to the rulemaking. So if those people are still around, they could maybe move towards the front. And for clarification, the tactical testifier is the one that generated this document that's the committee was given?
Ms. Fitzpatrick?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking through here, you've got a lot of data. I see a thing on the map on the second page, and it gives a percentage of mothers with children. I'm not finding the same information for fathers with children under six, and is it just missing?
Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we chose to focus on mothers because mothers do tend to have lower labor force participation rates than fathers. I could provide that data for you about fathers. It would probably be even higher.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it would be nice, since I assume this bill allows bonding for both parents, and therefore it would be nice if we actually had the data that was for both so we could understand, because I'm assuming this data was key and important for us to have for consideration of this bill, and it is only including half the picture. And then on to the bonding, or not the bonding, the benefit and rulemaking for the benefit. I was wondering, they've got $68 million set for it, so they must have done some preliminary studying, and I would like to find someone that could tell me what similar type of systems are in place, because looking through the bill and the structure and the definitions, they've got 90% of the up to the first 50% of the average, and then 66% of 50 to 100, and 55% of 100 plus. That seems somewhat complex and variable computational analysis of wage and salary, and it'd be nice to understand what existing systems there are. Are we going to have to build a whole new system and structure rulemaking to implement for this complex benefit that's set up in this bill? I mean, you just don't wave your hands and have something like that appear, and that structure has to be set up by the, underneath some rules, guidelines, and implementation.
Representative Halverson, yes, if you could narrow your answer just to the necessity of rulemaking.
I'll do my best. I will provide the background, because I think it was kind of confusing in terms of what we were talking about. So what Representative Quam is referring to is that the benefit is going to pay out on a percentage based on your income, which is based on the average weekly wage in Minnesota. And it is a tiered system so that the lowest wage workers actually can recoup 90% of their benefits. Those are people who are closest to the nice edge of the economy, although I don't know a lot of families who can miss 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or more of pay. So, and that goes all the way down to 56% of wages for highest paid earners. That does two things. It creates some efficiency in the system, some affordability in the system for the state and for employers and employees, but it also does not create any kind of incentive. I hear a lot of concern that, people are going to be incentivized to just willy-nilly take off 24 weeks, which would be exceptionally rare in this bill, and that is the purpose for that. Ms. Fitzpatrick, Professor Fitzpatrick, can help with the greater detail briefly.
If you could keep it brief, that would be great, Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Representative Halverson represented, the progressive payout structure works so that every single worker gets 90% of their first, roughly 50% of the statewide average weekly wage, 66% between that and the statewide average weekly wage, and 55% after that. Other states have moved in this direction of having a progressive payout structure for the reasons that Representative Halverson articulated. I think it's a relatively straightforward process to apply those percentages to a person's wage base, and other states are doing that well, and I think we have the ability to build on, again, our UI system here to do that in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the, some of the rulemaking is how do you treat part-time workers with variable hours and calculations, and also what happens if you're doing partial, dividing it up. In HHS, there's a lot of things that trigger $1 more and you shift over, and they've got issues with if you work more hours during, this month versus that month, and the averaging and et cetera, what type of implementation would be made for that? Plus, for how do you calculate and understand the different definitions of the employees if it is a seasonal type? What rules and implementation do we expect to be coming into effect here?
Representative Quam, we can't speculate about every rule that might be necessary, again, as I mentioned in the first bill, Ms. Fitzpatrick, if you have any general idea, that would feel free to
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the process for determining the wage replacement is largely in the bill. It's a look back over the last four full quarters, and it averages the wages during the highest quarter. It pulls in all wages from all employers, so it is designed to address exactly the kind of population that you were mentioning. I think there might be some additional details that would need to be worked out in rulemaking, but we are trying to get as much specificity on that process into the bill as possible.
Thank you. Great answer. Representative
Thank Paul. You, Mr. Well, yes, it is somewhat complex, but being, what they already have, $68 million in the budget for the initial, because that was, Commissioner testified that on it earlier, and it looks as if there's what local government, they indicated it'd be about $68 million from them. So it's a rather large, complex system. And do we have an existing system that's functional? Because, frankly, are we going to use an existing system so that then you're just writing new rules for implementing a variation with the system we have? I'm trying to understand what exactly the beast we're buying.
Thank you, Representative Quam. It sounds like most of the specifics are spelled out in the bill, but I don't know if you have any additional clarification to add, Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the bill is written, for example, to allow the state to, as much as possible, build on the revenue collection system that's already in place for the unemployment insurance system. Similarly, we're working with the department to make sure that, to the extent we can build on the benefits payout structure, infrastructure that's already built and functioning well in the state of Minnesota that we can do that. Yes, indeed, there will be some things that are slightly different because the policies are slightly different, but some of those things would be addressed in rulemaking.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about the implications of this new employment tax structure. Are there any federal intricacies? Because I understand when we were trying to do some activity in regards to the some health care things, and we thought we could get all the information through our Department of Revenue, but there are some things where we have to have a special licensed accessibility to the federal IRS data pool. And I'm wondering, is there any anticipation that we would, with this, have to interact with any federal entanglements and restrictions and hoops? And I would assume somebody from our nonpartisan staff might be the more likely person.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is true that if we were to actually use the UI system, that would require federal permission. The idea here is to clone those elements as much as possible, to not use the actual system. That would allow us to create a seamless coordination behind the scenes for employers and workers, so that we're minimizing the burden on them. But the cloning then doesn't require us to actually use that infrastructure that has been developed for UI. But it does allow us to build on our expertise and the well-functioning system that is there.
Representative Quam, I know some members of your caucus would like this to proceed a little quicker.
Well,
but
Mr. Chair, the duty to do due diligence is to my constituents and the people of the state of Minnesota. And no offense, the members of my caucus, frankly, you come second to the constituents and the citizens of Minnesota. Now, the discussion of cloning a federal system gets into, I would assume, it's the data that's important, and it's the data that's in utilization of that data that is federally regulated and would require the licensing. And, we're not a foreign entity that can hack in and clone a federal system. So I think we would still have to follow the actual rules and guidelines stipulated by federal regulations. And so that's what I'm trying to understand. It does appear as if this could entail that. And in previous legislative activities, it became very evident that you add months, if not years, to the time to implement if you're getting involved with being an additional access. And that was from the Dayton administration in Minute, where I got those discussions with, and the Department of Revenue. So I assume that the rules just don't automatically change because Minnesota decides to change it. They're dictated by the federal government.
Representative Halverson?
It sounds like Representative Quam's concerns are focused around the parts of the bill that oversee data collection, data sharing, and taxes, and we actually are going both to judiciary and to taxes. We will have lengthy discussions on those portions of the bill.
Yes, this I was going to mention that this is a mandatory referral for civil law for data privacy issues, which is not really a government.
Mr. Chair, has
Representative Quam, continue, please.
Has the staff determined whether, by doing the author's amendment and deleting out the rulemaking authority, if this is even in the purview for this committee to hear?
Yes, I could. I will be making a motion to reconsider the amendment, which I will fully explain, but I was waiting until you've completed with your questioning to do that.
I think it would be prudent to see where it takes us.
Okay, sure. So there was a typo in the amendment that House Research has informed me of. So this is news to Representative Halverson, I suspect, as well. Mr. Carlson has an eagle eye and was correct in catching it, so we appreciate it, and we appreciate his attendance to the bill. The numbers on line 2.25 of the amendment should read to delete lines 24 to 28, and they should not read delete lines 9 through 10. So I will, just that is a typo. I think typos are within the ability of this committee to amend, so I will move to reconsider adoption of the A5 amendment. Is there any discussion to that motion? Okay, seeing none. I would like to incorporate the correction I mentioned.
We will vote.
Delete. Maybe I should have House Research explain it, just so everyone's totally clear.
Mr. Chair, the process is to have the committee first vote to reconsider adoption of the A5 amendment, which is part of the vote. And then next, what you would do is incorporate a change on line 2.25, as you suggested. It is to delete the reference to lines 9 and 10 and insert the reference to lines 24 to 28, which you can do once you...
Okay. Gotcha. So I've moved to reconsider the amendments. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion passes. So with the discussion about what the correction was, is there additional discussion to that? Okay, so the amendment is before us. All those in favor of the amendment to the A5 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, the motion carries. Is that sufficient, or do we need to reconsider the amendment?
The amendment?
Then we need to adopt the amendment.
Okay. Okay, I will move the A5 amendment as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Okay. The motion carries. We have the re-amended bill before us. Representative Nelson, you are next on the list.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask about that. Was one of my questions. But the other was, I think maybe you need to schedule an evening meeting where we can have Judge Pust and Judge Lippman to come in here and explain the rulemaking process. It seems like today we've had a lot of questions about rulemaking. Maybe we need to re-examine that with all of our members of the committee so that they know what the rulemaking is about, because the questions that are being asked about rulemaking are very basic, and maybe we need to go over that again.
Sure. I appreciate that suggestion, Representative Nelson. I will consider it. We did have an overview on the rulemaking process from House Research at the beginning, but perhaps an informational hearing after the committee deadline when we don't have all those bills before us on the administrative hearing process. Maybe even a field hearing, a field trip to the Office of Administrative Hearings office. It would be in order. Doesn't that sound exciting, members? Okay. Well, I do not have any other members on the list. So seeing none, Representative Halverson, do you have any closing remarks?
Mr. Chair, looking at the time and recognizing that I have a sick child at home, I will just say I would appreciate member support, and the employees and employers of Minnesota will benefit greatly from healthier and well cared for families.
Okay, thank you for those statements. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 5, as amended multiple times, be considered for passage and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, there was a roll call request.
Oh, I apologize. There was a roll call requested. So you seemed so eager to leave, I thought I forgot that that was necessary. So the clerk will take the roll on the bill.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Representative Gomez.
Yes.
Representative Cagle.
Yes.
Representative Lee.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski. Representative Sauk.
Yes, sir.
Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
No.
Representative Heinrich.
No.
Representative Lehman.
No.
Representative Nash.
Nope.
Representative Quam.
Yes.
Representative Tice.
No.
Representative Vogel. Representative West.
Okay. There being 10 ayes and 6 nays, the bill is passed as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. So because we were so efficient, we will not need to reconvene tonight. So our next meeting will be on Thursday, February 28th. We do have several bills on the agenda, so it's possible we will go late to 12:30 and reconvene if necessary in the evening then as well. With that, this meeting is adjourned.